You're listening to the Radiator 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Monday, August 16th, and you're going to hear an interview this afternoon with Howard Norman, whose latest book is What is Left, the Daughter. Howard Norman is a three-time winner of National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships and a winner of the Lannan Award for Fiction. His 1987 novel, The Northern Lights, was nominated for a National Book Award, as was his 1994 novel, The Bird Artist. He's also author of the novels The Museum Guard, The Haunting of L, and Devotion. His books have been translated into 12 languages. The narrator of Howard Norman's latest novel, What Is Left, the Daughter, is Wyatt Hillier. At the age of 17, Wyatt is suddenly orphaned when his parents, within hours of each other, jump off of two different bridges, the result of their separate involvements with the same neighbor. The suicides cause Wyatt to move to a small town, middle economy, to live with his uncle, aunt, and ravishing cousin, Tilda. Setting in motion the novel's chain of life-altering passions and the wartime perfidy at its core is the arrival of the German student Hans Mullring, carrying only a satchel. Embedded in the story are actual historical incidents, including a German U-boat's sinking of the Nova Scotia Newfoundland ferry Caribou, on which Aunt Constance Hillier might or might not be traveling. Wyatt's account of events leading up to his fathering of a beloved daughter spills out 21 years later. The novel is a confession that speaks of the mysteries of human character in wartime and is directed with both despair and hope to an audience of one. In a review of this book for Amazon, former Write the Book guest Howard Frank Mosher calls What Is Left, the Daughter, the best story of love in the time of war that he has ever read. And he goes on in that review to confirm, yes, that includes Cold Mountain and A Farewell to Arms. Howard Norman teaches in the MFA program at the University of Maryland. He lives in Washington, D.C. and in Vermont, and he is married to the poet Jane Shore. I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago. We began by talking about his beginnings as a writer.
I came to write professionally, I guess one would say, really by indirection. I had no agenda. I was raised between Canada and the Midwest. Mm-hmm. That was my axis. In my middle teens and late teens, I started working in Canada, in the interior of Canada. And that went over about an 8 or 9 year period of time. I was working for film groups, museum groups, the Canadian Film Board, a variety of things. I had a dual citizenship, mm-hmm. and it afforded me the opportunity to construct a kind of, well, at least a prototype of a freelance writing life. At the time, the utilitarian element of that was working for specific employers like museums. And I would go into these places and they were language-intensive native languages, Northern Cree, but especially Inuit, mm-hmm. along Hudson's Bay. Mm-hmm. And they were very formative years in terms of listening to how other cultures thought narratively, because they weren't written languages. These are oral languages. So if you were to look at that memoir I wrote called In Fond Remembrance of Me, it's a chronicle of what it was like to work in Inuit communities and be infantilized in terms of language, mm-hmm. and then work your way up from like a five-year-old to speak with adults. And all the time it was unknown to me, a kind of literary apprenticeship, because I was hearing folk tales and I was hearing in other languages and keeping journals.
How old were you talking?
Well, that was from about 18 to 30.
Okay.
This includes life in Toronto. This includes a whole range of attempts to construct some kind of professional life. It was very ad hoc and not organized, but diligent, and I was paying my own bills. when I left that, at least as a full-time profession of writing treatises and notebook entries and things for museums, I started also writing about wildlife, about birds especially, which I do to this day. I moved to a place where I had never been before, which was Cambridge, Massachusetts. I just picked it out on a map and went, because I thought colleges, young women, movies, libraries, and cafes. Mm-hmm. So there was some sense of having had failed romances, of not knowing how to engage past a basic undergraduate education, but a passion for writing, but most of it was projected. Like, I had no experience with it. I had met writers, I knew writers, and then I met Jane. Now, Jane was already very well established as a poet. She had worked with Elizabeth Bishop, Robert Lowell. She had gone to the Iowa Writing School. And she was secure in the knowledge of who she was as a writer from a very young age. These were stark contrasts. I don't want to exaggerate that, but it was very, very clear that her background and her poise and the level of engagement she already had with writing was worlds beyond me. Mm-hmm. And I had all these savings, and I started to work on books of translation from Arctic languages and so forth, which came out. And I was again piecing together a writing life. And two things happened. One, Andy Zellman, who was the editor of the Boston Globe Sunday magazine, okay, started publishing fiction. And she published all my short stories. She completely was my livelihood for 2 years. And along with that was Jane, who kept saying, you know, do whatever you want, but why would you think that I would want to be with somebody who says he wants to write this novel and isn't doing it? Like, what? How does that reflect on us, you know? I love you anyway, but... And I understood what she was saying. I mean, it was not an ultimatum. It was a question that required some soul-searching. And so I began a novel which came out when I was 38 years old.
And was that the Northern Lights?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I had been writing all along. I had been engaged in various genres of translation and so forth. And I privately probably considered myself a writer tentatively. Then when that novel came out, things changed in a small way. I mean, for me, mm-hmm, personally. Mm-hmm. I started to teach a little bit more. I published the book of stories, and then I started The Bird Artist.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you were nominated for the National Book Award.
For both books. Yeah, and so that the response of a first novel for me was paradoxical. One was I was happy and I thought it was interesting and great. On the other hand, I knew the weaknesses of that book and in some senses that it represented a typical beginning of a writing life, of a fiction life, if you will, because it was a coming of age story. And, you know, I have no regrets, but if one had to do it over again, I would have chosen something else. But you only can write what you're writing. Yeah, for a first novel. And, you know, you can only write about what you are capable of at the time. But when I look back on that, I realize that it had certain qualities which were probably quite predictable.
Well, it had a pretty good outcome.
The outcome was lovely. But one always judges oneself far more harshly. So that by the time you have a book come out, and I've been extremely fortunate with the reviews of this new book, really beyond my wildest dreams. But in some ways you have an impunity because you've already put yourself through so much that nothing anyone says can even remotely have the same import as what you hopefully have put yourself through with that book. That's marketplace stuff. Aesthetically, if you thought you were going to have regrets about something, you shouldn't publish it. So that first novel afforded me, which would be late for some writers and not late for others, the chance to think of myself a little differently, mm-hmm. cautiously but differently. And then I worked for a couple more years on The Bird Artist, and that sort of changed me again, because then I got this job in Maryland, and the writing life and the teaching life worked then as a kind of sponsorship of each other. But I was 45 by that time.
Interesting.
Whereas Jane, when I first met her, I mean, when I say well-established, I mean really well-established.
Yeah.
But personally and in terms of literary culture. So I was always just watching this and seeing how different backgrounds and different understandings of one's own life functioned. And, you know, she's extremely impressive this way. And consistent. You know, be ambitious for your work, not yourself. And that's a great model. I mean, she happened to be my wife as a model, but she was. Yeah.
It's interesting. So many things in life happen based on, you know, the choice to move to Cambridge, Massachusetts out of...
We met a different way. I mean, it was through friends, but... Absolutely. I mean, there, to some sense, it was arbitrary. I was offered a job in Vancouver. I could have just as easily gone there. And life would have been very different.
Mm-hmm.
But you wouldn't have known it. My friend Helen Tanizaki, who I wrote this book about the Arctic about, when she was dying of stomach cancer, she used to look at these books of these field guides to birds, because she wanted so badly to be reincarnated as a bird. And I said, so you feel you have a choice, like if you pick that bird. And she looked at me, she said, since you won't know anyway, you might as well give yourself some agency, you know, while you're alive. And I thought, yeah, you only know the life you have. You don't know the life you don't have. So had I gone to Vancouver, who knows?
I wanted to ask how you came to write What Is Left, The Daughter.
Yeah.
And what was the initial impulse?
Well, I think the cliche is really true, that you finally find out the reasons for writing a novel by writing it. So that when I often get asked, idiosyncratically, why did you place a novel in the Maritimes of Canada?
Mm-hmm.
My answer to that, and I don't mean this facetiously at all, is that if it's a good book and the characters come alive and the story comes alive with some vividness, that answers that question.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a weak book, the question is valid, like why didn't you choose somewhere else and some other characters? But if it's a successful book literarily, it answers the question that you're interested in the types of people that live in this place. You're interested in how history affected their lives. You're interested in everything about them. It's a total exercise in vicariousness. And they are your social life. This story, however, I would say awkwardly, but this is the best way I can put it, it's the most journalistic of my novels. I haven't written very many. But of the ones I have written, I would say this is the most journalistic, in the sense that the precipitating incident, which was the sinking of the ferry Caribou in October of 1942 by a U-boat called the Laughing Cow,
mm-hmm.
are facts. The research was about the effects of that incident and the cumulative effect of U-boat sinkings on the psyche and the nature of daily life in the Canadian Maritimes, but especially Nova Scotia, and even more especially Halifax. And there are a lot of archival materials. There are enough people still alive to talk to about it. survivors of that ferry I talked to.
Mm-hmm.
So I did my homework. But research should only inform a sense of verisimilitude in a book. If you want to write, if you just want to impart information, write a nonfiction book. What I was especially interested in was the kinds of sort of race crimes that happen when a culture is in extremis. When September 11th happened and these Somalian fellows were beaten up in, I believe it was Portland, Oregon, I may have that wrong, I thought right away, that's the kind of situation, wrong time, wrong place.
Mm-hmm.
So in my book, I base it on, again, circumstances that actually happened. Young German students at Dalhousie University were under extreme pressure and extreme prejudice, even though here they were not at all connected with the psychotic Third Reich. Many of them were Jewish. And yet, the incendiary nature of people's responses struck me as a very familiar circumstance. And so this young man, Hans Moring, who's courting a young woman, is in the small town when the woman he's courting's mother is killed on a ferry sinking. And that led to a fatal sequence of events.
Right.
And I was very interested in the chronology of that. But even more so, if I were to be asked what the central event of this story is, I would not say it was the violent act of the sinking of that ferry. To me, it's about how quick life can change. You go from a kind of intensified, and in their case, accelerated romance, maybe accelerated because they sensed somehow that life was going to change, which is no different than people getting married before one goes off to war. And the violation of history on this relationship. My books tend to be about, and I want them to be about, the most difficult possible courtships. I like living in that world.
Yeah.
Because for a number of reasons, not the least of which is that I think that what we talked about before is actually true. If you're not in exactly the right time and the right place in your life, you will not meet the love of your life. And you will always know it, but there will be nothing you can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was so terrifying a prospect for me that it became a kind of persistent investigation in my novels,
mm-hmm.
including the one I'm writing now.
The next one.
Yeah. The central incidents for me are the near impossibility of love, which sounds corny, but if you put people in certain circumstances, you can then demonstrate what you mean by that.
Right.
And so that's the construction of a context in which people are struggling not to fall in love, but to actually live with the love they've chosen. And I like that a lot as a novelist. And so that's the central incident for me in this book, and that's the kind of research that I did. And that's the formative elements of where that all came from.
Okay, thank you. I liked the way that, structurally, I enjoyed this sort of love triangle at the beginning, maybe as an undercurrent.
That's a good pun for this book.
Yeah.
Undercurrent, because the undercurrents become the main currents.
Yes, right.
Absolutely.
At the beginning of the book, there's a double suicide that takes place because two people were in love with the same woman.
Another triangle.
So I sometimes wonder when I look structurally at a book and the way that it's laid out, you know, what came first? Did you go back and add that, or was that something that occurred early on in the process of writing the book?
Well, I'd say that's probably the most central question you could ask, really, honestly. Yes, I have a predisposition toward triangles in that regard. not only because I think they happen all the time, but because one doesn't want to write a simple adultery story. That's boring to me. A man falls in love with someone and develops a secret life. A woman does the same. I have no interest in it. I have no interest in reading about it. Past Anna Karenina. I have no interest in reading about it. Not because somebody can't write beautifully about that and do write beautifully about it, but because there's a kind of banality, a kind of mundanity to it for me. However, I do create a kind of bracelet of interlocking triangles in my books. And within the evolution of writing any book, the things that are set down at first intuitively or impulsively are formalized by the rewriting. So after the third or fourth draft, you know what you've done, and the question is, to what extent do you want to write about those things? And in this book, for instance, it went through, I think, 11 drafts, which has no meaning except that's just what it took. All the characters were present at the beginning. I have never had that happen before. Usually somebody shows up, in a sense. And I don't know why that is. I think perhaps because it percolated so long. It was a story I had started to think about and mull over and keep notebooks on 15 years ago.
Okay.
So the equation between who actually are the citizens of your book is often determined earlier on. You know, there's a kind of Darwinian quality where everything has to continue to earn itself into the story. That's why my books are so pared down and spare and understated and so forth, because I mean, I'd like to write a very flourishing kind of language, but my particular kind of being autocratic, as all writers are, has to do with sentences. And also with people in the Maritimes who think and speak a certain way.
Your voice seems to me to reflect the sense of place.
It's laconic.
Yeah.
There is a poet who, you know, I suppose you'd say she's somewhat self-published back in the 1920s in Halifax. You find pamphlets of her work every once in a while. No one knows about her. She's not in any anthologies and so forth. But she has a line that has served as a kind of talisman for me. It goes, I listened through the door to my auntie speaking. Storms informed her voice.
Hmm.
And that's what I really feel. That is to say, Shirley Moran Smith, hyphenated. She was probably in her 90s when she wrote that.
Mm-hmm.
Storms informed her voice, certainly on a surface level, implies an emotional turbulence.
Mm-hmm.
But I actually think it makes a connection for me about how the weather and the light infuses a person in ways they can't really always know, but it still has an effect.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a young girl listening to an older woman with the acoustical intervention of a door between them. And still the voice has a power and melancholy and broodingness to it that she remembers. And that, if I can get some of that in a book, I'm really happy. Nova Scotia is like that for me.
Mm-hmm.
But writing it is an exercise in displacement of the imagination. I mean, I don't write in Halifax. I visit Halifax and I come back here to write. So you create a kind of seance, you know.
Sure.
You bring that place to you and you live in that, and then you cook dinner.
Now, you mentioned that you grew up between two places. And yet it seems that
absolutely
your books are very Canadian-based.
Yes.
That's just what happens.
But let me point out what I think has been in... And I do really appreciate you mentioning the element of bifurcation.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you'd call it a flaw or not, but I know it was a habit that was influential for a number of books in a row. The Northern Lights, The Bird Artist, The Museum Guard, and The Haunting of Elle.
Mm-hmm.
While they're very different, they have one structurally unifying aspect, and that is that the whole story is not developed in just one place. In the Northern Lights, they move from the subarctic to Toronto. So you have to shift everything.
Mm-hmm.
In The Bird Artist, it's mainly in Witless Bay, Newfoundland, but they do take a trip outward to Halifax, and then you have to reestablish life again. In The Haunting of Elle, they go from the Arctic to Halifax. In The Museum Guard, an epistolary life connects Halifax to Amsterdam. So, with this book, What Has Left the Daughter, I was bound and determined to make the demographics more cohesive. Yet still, there's Halifax and Middle Economy, which is a real town. But it's only a couple hours apart.
Okay.
So I think I'm getting there somehow.
We're coming together.
Yeah. And in the afterlife, I think I'm going to write a book in which people don't leave home. But one doesn't sit around thinking about these things except in ways that might be instructive. And I was very aware of not wanting to repeat that again.
Mm-hmm.
I was aware to the point of self-consciousness about it. I at one point thought maybe they should go somewhere else, but it didn't make any sense. But there's always an axis, isn't there? I mean, you go from home to a bakery and back. It creates two emotional counterpoints.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm interested in that. I'm interested in that.
Yeah. I'm wondering if maybe you could read from the book.
Sure.
So this is Howard Norman reading from What Has Left the Daughter, and it's published by
Houghton Mifflin Harcourt.
Sorry.
Two companies have combined.
They don't change so much.
Yeah, they've all combined, but the dolphin on which the person is riding and the logo is still going in the same direction. So I'm optimistic. What Has Left the Daughter? Marlis, today is March 27th, 1967, your 21st birthday. I'm writing because I refuse any longer to have my life defined by what I haven't told you. I've waited until now to relate the terrible incident that I took part in on October 16th, 1942, when I was 19. Your mother, Tilda Hillier, frequently consulted the Highland Book of Platitudes, which had 411 pages. She had it practically memorized. She found instruction and solace in that book, even the solution to certain puzzles about life. But I thought all those platitudes put together avoided the fact that life is unpredictable. For instance, after moving hotel to hotel here in Halifax for many years, I finally returned to my childhood house at 58 Roby Street, which I never thought I'd set foot in again. In fact, it's now 3 a.m., I scarcely sleep anyway, and I'm writing at my kitchen table. Two Sundays ago, I stopped in at Harbor Methodist Church. On occasion, I do that, more out of nostalgia than present faith, to say the least. Anyway, when I entered the church, Reverend Lundrigan was recounting some ancient parable or other in which an elderly woman listens to her son hold forth about how much heartbreak, sour luck, and spiritual depletion can be packed into a life. But talk as he might, the man from the parable fails to address the one thing his mother is most curious about. What of your daughter, she asks. Have you seen her? How is her life? Do not doubt that wonderment may be found when you find her again. Turns out the man hasn't seen his own daughter in ages. Rain, wind, hunger, thirst, joy, and sorrow have visited her all along, the woman says, yet her father has not. She listens more, all the while experiencing a deeper and deeper sadness, until finally she says, "And what has left the daughter?" She doesn't mean heirloom objects. She doesn't mean money. She doesn't care about anything like those. She says, "I think you have a secret untold that keeps a distance between you and her and the life you were given." Well, Marlis, you know how people talked in biblical times. Still, when I left the church, I thought, strange how you can't predict during which happenstance you might take something to heart. And right there and then, I understood that all I had to leave you, really, is what I'm writing here. I've read some of the English poet John Keats, and he said something to the effect that memory shouldn't be confused with knowledge. Of course, I have no way of knowing if, after you've read a paragraph or two, any curiosity you might have had will abruptly sour to disgust or worse. Yet I hope you'll see these pages through, and that whatever else you may think, whatever judgments you come to, please at least accept the knowledge that I've always loved you without cease.
Thank you very much. So that's the opening to the book, and yet the narration continues to take the form of a letter.
Yes, it's an epistolary novel.
Right, right. So how was that? Did you enjoy with that?
Yes. I've noticed reviewers, gratefully, I'm grateful for this, have commented on, I guess one would say, the antique narrative strategy of an epistolary life. I think it's completely a Western phenomenon, that absence. In Europe, people publish epistolary novels. There's such a long precedent for it. In this case, it's one letter. And so, technically, it's an epistolary novel, but idiosyncratically, it's really just one long letter.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you sustain a sense of intimacy and awkwardness in a man looking back, a number of years, whose intent is to persuade a daughter to see him again, without it being solipsistic and without it being sentimental?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that the only way you could do that was through the sheer force of honest self-assessment and honest description. Having said that, you also want to be presenting a reliable narrator, somebody that isn't fraudulently concocting a literary-sounding voice. Because this guy's not literary. He's rather hapless in a lot of ways. But one thing that I feel strongly is that if you say of a character, he or she is too passive, you are missing what I think is an important point, is that the telling of a story is never passive. And someone's actions in the story might be passive or reactive, but the act of telling your life isn't. So that's a paradox in the books I write.
Uh-huh.
Where people say, God, that person's so passive, but he's not, because he's telling...
The very nature of narration is active.
Is active. And not only active, but active in a creative sense.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Wyatt Hillier, who's narrating this, creative for the first time in his life,
mm-hmm.
one never gets the sense that he's even ever written a letter before. And that's fine. I mean, you create your own criterion for writing a book. The earlier a reader can suspend disbelief, the better it is. Because everything is implausible on some level, and I was very comfortable with an epistolary novel.
Well, in his direct address of Marlis isn't constant. It's not twice a page. It's not intrusive at all. It's just there mildly throughout to remind us.
Yes, but you astutely point out an act, again, of craft and willfulness, if you don't mind me using those words. In a first draft, the name Marlis is spoken are written every 8 or 10 sentences.
Okay.
You have to
think of her reading it in order to write it.
And
sorry, I'm putting words in your
and mind. Exactly. No, that's it. That's it. And also the fact that an insomniac man who's full of all sorts of contradictory emotions is going to have to remind himself every once in a while that he's really speaking to someone else and not trying to convince himself that what has happened to him has actually happened. So I thought that the direct address was twofold, one to the daughter and one to himself.
Mm-hmm.
And by inference, to us as readers, but not to him. I mean, it would just be his daughter and himself.
Right. One of the things that you read when you read that little opening, I actually had wanted to talk about, and that is the line from that Bible story. The story has to do with untold secrets causing problems in the lives of those who keep those secrets. And later in this novel, the theme returns that it's not possible to live secret lives, or that the deepest meaning sometimes comes from a secret that you can't pursue in some way. And I like this, that secrets were so important, and because the story has to do with love, as we've been talking about, with difficult love, with war, with the German U-boats that are hidden. You know, there's several levels on which there are mysteries and secrets in this book.
My wife does not have to worry about me having a secret life, because my own life is so secret to me. I mean, you know, your unconscious, your imagination is your secret life, mm-hmm. I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think how that is played out in a community is really what I'm talking about. Let me try to give you an example, if you don't mind. In The Bird Artist, you had this tiny little Newfoundland outport community. And lives were somewhat available and transparent. And even though a woman has an affair with the lighthouse keeper, did they not think that everyone saw somebody travel out to the lighthouse and back? That wasn't a secret life. It was just a life that people had resistances in talking about. The secret life of that village is the heart-wrenching fact that along the Maritimes of Canada, many of the graves are empty because people died at sea.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the presentation of propriety and ceremony and formality with epitaphs and elegies and the literature of gravestones. But the people aren't there. There's always a deeper secret than people's lives. There's a secret of history, and I'm really drawn to those things.
Yeah.
So, but I do think it's true that the what's the song that the band sings? Richard Manuel's lyrics. That there's no song as strong as the song Unsung, or something along those lines. It will eventually surface. And allow me to say that Nova Scotia and many places in the world archive secrets in a lot of ways. One of them is skip rope songs. If you listen to little primary girls, but not exclusively girls, skipping rope in a school in Cape Breton, and you listen to what they're actually saying, it's horrifying. It's often about the sinkings of ships. It's often about drownings. But it's formalized in these cadences and this lovely sound of little girls skipping rope.
Right. Sort of like Ring Around the Rosie.
Exactly like.
Yeah.
If you can replicate that dichotomy in creating an emotional atmosphere in a novel, if I can, to even a little extent, I'm really happy. But it takes a lot. You know, what you hear when you first hear it has one import. And then when you listen closely, your life is changed completely. And those kids don't know what they're singing. I mean, they kind of do.
They might be shocked later when they learn.
They're the messengers. Mm-hmm. And that really interests me.
Mm-hmm.
That really interests me.
Before we move off of the specifics of this novel, I wanted to just ask you if you could talk just a little bit about developing Wyatt's character. And I particularly liked the energy between Wyatt and Hans. I felt that you captured very, very well Wyatt's resentment and his sarcasm. But there's also, unless I'm reading too much into it, I felt that there was a grudging respect he felt for Hans, and he was impressed by him, and there was a sort of undertone of humor running between them. And I thought that must have been hard to do, to infuse this relationship with so much on so many levels. Am I right? Or?
Well, I'm glad you thought it was infused on many levels. Again, a tableau like that,
mm-hmm.
on one level, could have sustained a whole novel.
Mm-hmm.
If I would have kept it to 3 weeks of that courtship and made it all about language and philology in the dictionary,
right.
which I tried to eroticize the Webster's Dictionary. That's hard to do. You know, but I thought it was an extremely dignified attempt. I'm saying that laughingly.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm laughing at myself there.
The fact that they
would go to the library, which later is an erotic, literally physically erotic place, and that Wyatt would wonder which words they were discussing,
mm-hmm.
was euphemistic,
mm-hmm.
for everything for him. I mean, he was feeling hapless, and he admits it. He says, you know, I was illiterate in matters of the heart. Well, everything in that chapter has to do with language and words. Grudgingly admiring is not something I thought of till you said it. I thought he was fuming with self-indictment and envy and jealousy. And the larger question, though, is at the end of a whole book that's narrated first person, does the person come to some knowledge of themselves? And I'm not exactly sure what the truth is there, but I know that people comment on it. So then in that chapter you're referring to, his aunt Constance says, I listened in, and let me tell you what I heard. You're in love with Tilda. You think I am? Yes, I do. So he's 17, though, you know. And I think that's the difference. Hans just seems so worldly. And if I were to venture an autobiographical aspect of that, I would say that feeling of admiring another person's erudition is intrinsic to writers, that you try to make your characters articulate their lives, because simply articulating your own doesn't suffice. It's not that interesting, but their lives are interesting. Now, I'm writing a memoir now. I've written one before, or two. I wrote a travel memoir about Nova Scotia and for National Geographic, and then the memoir of that particular time in the Arctic. But this is a much more longer engagement. And I'm finding I have to impose fictional constructs on it. That is, ways to organize it, not the way to write it. It's not fiction. It comes from fiction.
The structural.
Yeah. The narrative strategies, if you will.
Right.
But, I think if I were to look back at the notebooks for this book, you're absolutely right. I wrote hundreds of pages of nasty dialogues between these two, including I had a scene in which Wyatt runs into Hans on the beach, sees him there, and they have this conversation, and it was about as forthright a thing as I've ever written, in which he just pours out everything he's thinking. Had I left it in, it would have been too much of a forecast of the violence that was actually done to Hans. But he's clearly wrought in the extreme and homicidal. Because he wants to kill this guy. I mean, he's taking his great love away from him almost by sheer force of language.
Yeah.
And he doesn't know what to do with that. And the fact that he participates in the murder of Hans Moring but doesn't instigate it, the fact that he does not stop it, is, to my mind, in equal measure, a murder.
Right.
And if I would have left that scene in of their private confrontation, it would have been too melodramatic.
Right, but I wonder if writing that scene helped you create what does exist between them.
Yes.
In the pages you kept.
By all means.
Yes.
And again, in the rewriting, part of the rewriting is editing back. Because writing a book is an altruistic enterprise. Everything that doesn't serve the book has to go.
Mm-hmm.
But did I have, in a sense, fun writing those things? Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm.
How do you engender in a reader comical sympathy for two somewhat awkward, at times unlikable characters?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if the grudging respect that I picked up on was more what you saw as envy. You know, and in order to feel envy, you have to want what someone else possesses.
What you access as the emotions that are informing your writing is not often well met with how a reader sees it. So both are true. Your truth as a reader may not have been the ambition I had as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could control a reader's response, why would you write? If a book sells 50,000 copies, you've allowed 50,000 varied opinions. You only are capable of the one you had. You know, I don't have very complicated attitudes toward my characters. They have complicated attitudes toward themselves, toward each other.
Right.
But I very much control how I, at least I want them to seem in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you succeed or fail at that. I mean, this is just me speaking just for myself, not for any other writer.
Well, we've pretty much come to the end of our time, and I always ask the same last question of my guests. For writers who are listening to our conversation, do you have any suggested advice for when they get stuck in their work? They have trouble facing the blank page.
Yeah, again, I'm very simple-minded about it. I think you write your way out of it. If you live in an area where there's pockets of quicksand. Most people that are raised in those areas are instructed from a young age how to get out of quicksand. You know, you're instructed on how to level your body, enlighten yourself, and swim out of it. So if you know in advance that you're going to be with a story for a while, there's quicksand along the way. You know you're going to get stuck. The only way to do it is to write through it. You know, honestly, unless there's some grief or anesthetizing sadness or depression, I don't see writer's block as anything but indulgent.
Mm.
That is to say, if you write every day a little bit, you have a habit of persistence and a discipline. And a lot of the days, and one might argue most days, nothing is kept. but nothing goes to waste either. The hard part is to calibrate the deepest level, to get into the deepest level of engagement with a story, mm-hmm. and work on it. And then when you're done with a book, there may be long periods of time where you don't have something you really want to write about. Mm-hmm. I think you can pretty much tell the type of writer that moves from one book to the next. There's a certain depth that's missing.
You said that you wrote probably 11 drafts of this novel. Do you find that it's hard when you get to the very end stage? Do you ever feel sort of tired of it and you're ready to move on? I'm just curious if that's a kind of writer's block too.
The only time I've ever felt that was with my very first novel. And I gave it to writer Peter Matheson, and he said, "Well, Howard, look, it's not as good as it perhaps could be or should be, but it's done. If you start it over again now, you are going to write a completely different book, and you don't want to do that." And, I mean, he was speaking generically, mm-hmm. I think. But past that book, no, I don't get tired. I would say the opposite is true of me, is that I start to have separation anxieties.
That's interesting.
You know, yeah. Because I tend to be concerned that I haven't done them justice. Mm-hmm. And, like, I don't want them to be angry that their lives weren't fully realized enough. So I think I'm the opposite in that regard. Of course, once a book comes out, it's been a year or 18 months, and you're on to something else. You're in a completely different thing. You've washed the dishes 50,000 times. You've fed the cats. You've taken a million drives. You've had endless glasses of wine. And it's not tangible anymore. E.M. Forster famously commented when shown a picture of him actually composing. He said, "I have no idea who that is." And I think that's really an honest thing to say.
Yeah.
I don't think there's any irony there at all. There's humor, but no irony. I have no idea the state of mind I was in, but a reader can figure it out, but not me, and I think it's useless to try to figure that out. I think, you know, you're on to something else, hopefully.
Right. Well, this was fun. Thank you very much for talking with me.
Oh, thank you.
That, again, was a conversation with Howard Norman. His latest novel, What Is Left the Daughter, is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. This week's Write the Book prompt is inspired by Howard Norman's work. At one point during our talk, he mentioned that the bifurcation of place in his novels creates multiple emotional counterpoints that appeal to him. As his characters move between two or more places, he, as the author, needs to reestablish their lives or shift everything, and this can be interesting. He also said, one doesn't sit around thinking about these things except in ways that might be instructive. And so to the extent that it might be instructive or interesting, your prompt this week is to consider introducing a second setting into your work. If you already have a storyline that takes place between two settings, study the work you've done and consider the ways in which you've created multiple counterpoints for your characters and their stories. If your narrative takes place in a single setting, consider what might change for the work if you were to introduce a second place. It might not make sense, but give it some thought. See if this could create an interesting shift in your story, novel, or prose poem. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3 p.m. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And you can check out upcoming shows by looking at my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Next week, Write the Book features an interview with local author and teacher Susan Weiss. This has been Write the Book.
I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont.
Thank you.